Amy Ray, founder, friend, human being.
Yes.
Welcome. Welcome. Before we get into who you are as a human being, I just want to hit some headlines because, number one, I can't really understand how this guy that I knew years ago has become this founder and CEO of a business that is over $50 million worth of revenue.
Yeah.
You're in 7 or 8 countries, New York, London.
Is New York a country?
It's a city.
Okay,
it definitely
sorry.
Is a city.
I'm throwing you off.
Fuck you. Korea.
Yes.
Brazil.
Yeah.
Mexico,
yes.
To be. Saudi Arabia. Dubai. Blah. I can carry on going, yeah. Right? Before we get into the story, because I really want to sort of dig into how this happened, where this came from, I've asked you to do something for us in this new series.
Yes. Which is very you, by the way. The ask was so you.
Indeed.
Just such an exhibitionist, always.
What's upset me is that you've not picked the rap.
Yeah, no, the rap is not.
Or the song.
I haven't got it in my locker.
Or the dance.
Not in my locker.
But you have picked a rant.
A rant.
Okay.
A hot take,
okay.
I would say. A hot take.
Okay.
Do you want to hear it?
Well, yeah. Before we get into the history, what is your rant? What really gets you grinding your gears?
So my hot take is I think cinemas are the most overrated place in human history. Genuinely, I think they are hell holes. And I've got a reason for this. Genuinely, because I was thinking about all the things that I hate in life, they can be found in the cinema. And I'm going to get brand specific as well. It's not any cinema. It's Everyman Cinemas. Okay, so...
Specifically Everyman.
Specific Everyman. Okay. There's a client or potential client that's gone. We didn't want them anyway. We do, I promise you.
We're keeping this in.
But when you think about cinemas, right... Think about the environment. You walk in. Number one, what do you know about me? I hate artificial heat. It is the hottest place on human earth. Okay, so you're paying £30 to watch Oppenheimer for 3 hours in a sauna. Number one.
Fair? Yeah.
Agreed?
Yeah.
Number two, in Everyman Cinemas, don't know if you sat in the seats, the fabric is very, very itchy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the Inferno's carpet on the walls. Like, you don't want to be pressed up against that for too long.
Yep.
Number two.
I'm with you.
Number three, in Everyman, the way they design it, the rows aren't elevated enough, so actually you're watching part film, part back of someone's head consistently.
Yes.
So you know when you go on Ticketmaster and you go to a stadium, it's like your view may be obstructed.
Yes.
Every man needs to make that disclaimer because you're watching part film, part back of Kevin's head, literally. Number four.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Then with Every Man, they have this whole come in, kick back, that vibe. It's very like kooky. It's like order food, we're bringing it to your seat, no worries. Then what ends up happening is the staff are constantly walking back and forth with like a 7-course meal, drinks. It's very obstructive and just uncomfortable in general. But then the food itself, if you think about it, it's hot dogs, it's sliders, it's nachos, it's wings. Like, it's just fried food. It just smells disgusting. And if I wanted to watch a film in that environment, I'd just bring my TV to McDonald's. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. And then also, the other thing that really, really gets me is popcorn. Why popcorn? Mm. It doesn't make sense. The rustling, the endless rustling that genuinely never ends. The chomping, like the Cookie Monster. It's horrific. It's like a sensory overload. By the way, you're getting into my brain as a human being.
Yeah, I am.
This is me. If you ask Lucy, this is all me right now. And the final thing, the genuinely final thing. What is the final thing? I had one more
sound?
Thing. No, it wasn't the sound.
Smell?
No, it's the fact that you can't go to the toilet.
Yeah, that is true.
It's like,
I was sort of stuck.
When you're
that.
At home, you can press pause, you can go to the toilet. When you're in cinema, you have to make a choice between miss a plot twist or soil yourself, basically. Like, it is that. So if you think about all those things, you've sat in a sauna, you paid £30 for the pleasure, you've probably got contact dermatitis from the seat. You smell like a kebab house. You've looked at Kevin's head for three hours. It doesn't make sense. Just watch it at home. And it's like, what? You have to watch on the day release? Like, grow up. You don't need to watch.
Fucking hell. Wow. Okay.
That is my rant. That is my rant.
No, fair. You didn't mention the sound. I find, maybe it's because my ears kind of stick out and I think I'm quite sensitive to noise. So normally when I'm in there, I'm like, why is
your ears
so
stick out? What's more noise?
Yeah, that's my entrance, theory. Like, okay. It just, like, if I'm cycling, I used to have this guy that said, like, if you cycle too fast, you take off.
Okay.
But, like, when I'm, like, the noise of the wind hits my ears. But that's the thing, the sweat.
It's the sweat, it's the textures, it's just the constant back and forth and moving. It's just...
I'm with you.
It's too much.
You've convinced me. Like, I was thinking about going to the cinema.
No, I walked out of Dune 2 after 20 minutes.
That's the film.
I looked at my wife and I was like, I can't do this. I was like, I'm not at ease here. I'm on edge.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Okay,
I
that's really, a rant.
I wasn't expecting, I don't know what I was expecting you to say.
What were you expecting? Like, I love my agency and I hate my competitors. Is that what you wanted?
No, I thought you were going to be more like something brand. No. I'm really happy that you went down the line, mainstream. No. Not even just Odeon, Everyman.
Everyman.
Okay, I've got a
no brands are harmed in the making of this pot.
Can we just beep that with Odeon every time we say Everyman?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So before, like, I want to use today to understand, A, like, where you've been and the business that you've created with Buttermilk. But, like, more importantly, I need to understand where is everything heading, because the listeners of this podcast are probably 60 to 70% agency people.
Yes.
The rest maybe more brand. I mean, the rest also people that are trying to figure out and discover, you know, there could be a 21-year-old person sitting at home going, how do I break into the creative industry? So three-part audience, but I think I want to spend a lot of today sort of understanding exactly how influencer or creator marketing worked, and then how you feel like it's going to work in the future.
Yes.
Before we do that, obviously I've hit the line that, you know, the figures and what you've created as a business is incredible. I want to know the beginning, a quick version of the beginning and how it started.
Yes.
And then I want to get into now and then to the future.
Yeah.
So how did this begin?
So I don't actually have any typical agency experience whatsoever. So I started out as a lawyer, did all of my training, got my training contract, went up to the city job for 2 weeks, hated every moment of it. Well, 2 weeks of it, which isn't that long. I didn't really stick it out. But I think intuitively, I just knew the corporate world wasn't for me. I'm very sort of left brain, right brain. In some ways, I'm sort of very strategic and buttoned up. In other ways, I'm a bit more creative and innovative. Mm. And I think that side of my brain ended up taking over. So I left that job. I had supportive parents, which helped. And then I went and interned at M&C Saatchi Merlin, the talent management division of M&C Saatchi.
Yes.
For a period of time. And this was around 2014, 2015, where sort of influencers were still called bloggers, but everyone started to speak about social talent. And I remember sitting in their kind of all agency update and the CEO was saying, okay, we need to get social talent. We need to get social talent. And I was like, okay, that's interesting, because a lot of my friends are influencers overnight. And I understand this world natively. Like, I was born on social. Like, natively, I understand what social is, what influence is. And I had this theory there was going to be a whole host of millennial founders operating in the service-based industry with influencer marketing. And actually, if you look at all of our competitors, we all started at the same time. We all started in the UK. We're all quite similar in some ways. So that theory ended up being correct. And then at the time, my friend Motez, who you know very well, anyone that knows Motez knows he can convince, you know, the Eskimos to buy ice at double the price. He is that person.
Also convinced you.
He convinced me. He convinced four people to leave law, by the way. Four people. That's like his, that would go on his gravestone. Would go on his gravestone, like genuinely. And he was like, let's start something. I was like, okay, yeah, let's start something. He's like, influencer marketing. I was like, cool, I've kind of heard a bit about this.
Yeah.
Let's do it. And genuinely, the first ambition was just to move out of my mum and dad's house. That was it. So we worked out Krispy Kreme donuts on the A3. You probably know it well.
Ah.
Yeah.
I've driven past that.
By the Golf Range, across from the Golf Range, is that Krispy Kreme donuts.
Okay.
So that was our office, because they had free Wi-Fi and they had a good bundle for coffee and donuts. But at 4 o'clock every day, school children would come in. So basically, you'd be on a call and then children would just always appear behind you. That was always quite strange. It was quite strange, to be honest. And we just emailed every single brand that would listen. Now, we would do this exercise where we'd go to Tesco's across from the Krispy Kreme, look at every brand on the shelf, get an email, and just email.
Really?
And we ended up getting a few meetings early on with Deliveroo. And we were just good at selling, to be honest. We were just good at selling, convincing people that they should believe in us.
What were you selling?
We were selling this idea that influencer was something you should test and learn in. Not, we weren't selling them the world. We weren't selling them multi-million pound retainers. We were selling them 5K, to be honest. I remember the first meeting we had with a client. We walked out and she looked at us and she was like, okay, I'll do 5K. Me and Motors looked at each other and we're like, shit. But like, genuinely,
for what?
Like, what do we do? And we went to our friend's house around the corner and we sat in this room and we're like, how do we do this? Like, genuinely, how do we do this? And I think we were so hyper paranoid that we ended up doing an amazing job.
Yeah.
And actually, if you look at my skill set and Motors' skill set, I'm legal training, I'm strategic, I'm commercial, I'm pragmatic. You know Motors, he's wild.
Yeah.
He's wild. He's an innovator, he thinks ahead. And you fuse those two skill sets together, you've got a deck and you've got a story, and that's all we needed.
And terms.
Yeah, terms. And terms. Although no one's tried to sue us.
Yeah.
Please don't, because it probably won't stand
every man
up.
If you're listening. Yeah.
Every man.
So, okay, two people.
Yes.
I want like the two inflection points.
Yes.
That will bring us to now. So from two people to pitching to brands that you're seeing in Tesco.
Yes.
To then, what was the next moment where you felt like, oh my God, this is actually working?
there was two big points. One, I think, is when we landed Dior as a client. That was 2017, 2018.
How many years after launching now?
That was a year and a half into launching.
How do you get...
Actually, we landed Deliveroo before then, but Dior felt like the biggest inflection point for me.
Why?
Because it's created leverage that we still sweat to this day, to be honest. People come to us now and said, you're the guys that did Dior. Can we work with you? And it was at a time where Dior, their lunch was getting eaten in every direction from a Dior beauty perspective.
Okay.
So they were thinking about Glossier. They were thinking about Kylie Cosmetics, but they were also thinking about Chanel, YSL. Yeah. And they were like, how do we compete in this fragmented landscape where attention is everywhere? And everyone was working with the same influencers at this stage. Mm. So we went in and just did a really innovative piece of work, which was connecting them to their fans. So like smaller creators at scale, created a whole Dior beauty lover community. And that was really ahead of its time, that piece of work. Yeah. And it just created that leverage. Like you have that and it's a snowball effect and you keep leveraging and leveraging and leveraging. And then we got very big in the beauty space. And then, yeah, just won tons of awards with that work.
So, what did that work do for Dior? And like, talk to me. Imagine there's a giant marketing budget that yes. Dior can spend to get themselves out of that place and become more distinctive or whatever their commercial objective is. Where does that money usually go? And like, what percentage were they giving to you at that time? And then what did that have in terms of an impact?
Yeah. Can I use another analogy for that?
Yeah.
I remember early on in 2018, we went to New York for this all agency meeting with one of our biggest clients at the time. And in the room, there was us, there was a PR agency, there was a media agency, there was a creative agency. And it was on the back of some work we had done and we were repitching for work. And they flashed up these slides and they'd forgot to remove the budget. And basically every agency there was on multi-million pound retainers. And it said, Buttermilk, said 20K. We've done this cute little campaign. We were at the end of the table. And they're like, oh, look at those guys. They're so cute. Like the interns, like chuck them a bone, see what they do with it.
Yeah.
But what materialized at the end of that meeting is when we were going through the work, this brand had a whole issue around brand reputation. They had an issue around relevance of their media, how much media they had. Mm. And what they realized is actually through our work, we had covered all of that off. And the other agencies were actually scrapping around to make impact. And I remember the CMO looked at us and was like, Buttermilk are the only guys doing work here. And this was in 2018. So
wow.
We didn't have sort of the credit on our name or the space.
No.
But it was clear that the impact was there. So at that time, we had been carved a minor percent of budgets, like minor percent.
Yeah.
Whereas now you look at the major conglomerates, some of them are spending 50% of their media budget on influencer.
What happened? And for brands, how are they... How is the ROI? How did the ROI become clearer to
yes.
brands?
Yeah. So I think the second inflection point, going back to your original question, is it was a combination of COVID and TikTok happening at the same time.
Okay.
So you think about COVID, what did it do? It created a stay-at-home economy. So you've got the stay-at-home economy with nothing to do. Then all of a sudden, TikTok launches. Well, it was around the year before, but it gained traction during COVID. And TikTok came sort of to fruition during that time. And if you think about how the algorithm works on TikTok, the idea is actually content is pushed on the basis of interest or creativity over follower count. So all of a sudden, you've got a stay-at-home economy with nothing to do. And you've got this device sitting in your hands who says, if I create content, I can go viral in the same way as someone with 10 million followers.
Mm.
So you get this mass proliferation of content from just everyday creators. So I think what happened is what was going to happen in 5 years in terms of the move towards influencer was accelerated because all of a sudden a stay-at-home economy had dictated that at-home content creation was quicker, it was more efficient, it was more culturally relevant, all of those things. So it kind of accelerated that whole progress.
So the Buttermilk story at that point, I'm guessing you were sort of between like 20 and 30 humans. And
at that point, yeah, exactly around 20 people.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then 2020 happens.
Yes.
Weird, because you're all working from home.
Yes.
And I guess you didn't get a measure of how much the business had grown until you went, shit, how do we get this into an office?
Yeah. Although there was still that shit the bed moment in COVID where it happened. And there was still like 6 months of uncertainty.
Yeah.
But then it was like everything all at once. And the money just started going towards influencer.
So it's a perfect storm.
Yeah.
2020 sped up what was always going to happen with influencer.
Yes.
And I guess that then meant that brands were much more aware of the return on investment if you went down this route.
Yes.
Did you have any moments in that time where you went, oh my God, like we used to be up against an Ogilvy, or we used to be up against this huge agency that had the majority of the budget, and now that we're seeing we are the major lion's share of the budget?
Yeah. I think it was more we used to be up against our competitors in a kind of subsection that we were just almost pushed into.
Yeah.
Whereas actually now we are pitching against the Ogilvies, we are pitching against the holding companies, we are pitching against the WPPs of this world. So it wasn't...
As clean cut.
It was actually who we were pitching against changed. Because I think what ends up happening is the money's going towards influencer. All of the big holding companies stand up and they take note, right? Because if money's flowing one way and it's not going into their pockets and it's going towards influencer agencies, that's why we've seen this whole M&A spree recently as well of the big holding companies, because they understand that's a major part of their lunch that's being eaten. So who we're pitching against now, it could be our typical independent competitors, but a lot of the time it is the WPPs, it is the publicists, et cetera. Yeah.
And how does that work out? So if you go up against, you know, a WPP, for an example, how comfortable do you feel up against them? And what's the angle?
I feel comfortable. Yeah. Yes. On the basis that when you think about influencer marketing, the advantage of influencer marketing is it's quick, it's culturally relevant, it's agile, it's a speedboat. And when you're going up against WPP, it's a tanker ship. Like, it is a tanker ship. It's a well-oiled tanker ship, you could argue, at times, maybe not at other times. But then clients want that cultural reactivity. Mm. And all of a sudden you put influencer marketing into a business or an infrastructure that doesn't have the speed or the sort of the foundation to be quick. And I've even, you know, heard from friends that have been at influencer agencies that have been absorbed into bigger holding companies. And they said internally, it can take 5 weeks just to get the thing signed off.
Yeah.
If it takes 5 weeks, the moment's gone.
You're too late.
The moment's gone. So I always feel like we have that agility that we can feed into, that always stands us apart from the big holding groups. There is something to be said, though. I think the holding groups, where they have the advantage, is just the sheer volume, scale, size, the RFI, what's your headcount, what's your turnover, the sort of tick box exercise. But I think we've got to a certain size now where we've overcome that ourselves. Yeah. Yeah.
Take me through what's changed, right? Because I'm getting, I think everyone, if we had anybody that had come from an independent influencer marketing creative business, would say 4 years ago it was still the Wild West.
Yes.
And it was kind of like, no one really knows, and making this thing up. What has changed? One of my questions I wanted to ask you is, like, would you launch an influencer agency knowing what you know now, today? And if the answer is no, or I'm not sure, what has changed since the Wild West days to now?
Yeah. Which question do you want me to answer first?
The first one. The Wild West. So, like, what's happened since the day that you started that's been the biggest change, I guess, from then to now?
Yeah. I think with any new segment of advertising, initially, it's just everything and you sort of chuck a lot of shit at the wall and see what sticks. And there was that moment to begin with where no one really knew what was going on, but then eventually the dust always settles and the cream kind of always rises to the top. And that's happened because there's just enough players in the space now. There's enough agencies in the space. There's enough tool providers in the space. There's enough SaaS companies in the space. So there's competition in the space. And when there's competition, you have to elevate what you're doing. So from a measurement perspective, from a strategy perspective, from a creative perspective. So it's naturally just happened over the course of time. Like, people can tangibly understand the impact of influencer now in the way that they couldn't in the early days, because no one really knew what they were doing, including the platforms. Like, I don't think they were designed for influencer marketing per se. It was a byproduct of just attention, right? Attention was going to the platforms, then influencers fed off that.
Yeah.
So that evolution now, what we just see is, like I say, measurement, reporting frameworks, strategy, creative. It's being benchmarked here, and people are constantly trying to sort of lift the bar. So the quality of outputs is constantly just improving naturally as the space has evolved.
Is there anything that you couldn't get away with now that you could have got away with then?
How honest do I be about this question? Do I care about my business?
Yeah, well, no. I mean, like, but you could say on the whole.
Yeah.
What I find interesting is that before you were almost advertising influencer marketing as a viable way to build brand, right?
Yes.
Whereas now you're not. Everyone understands it. You know, every agency is trying to do it to a certain extent. So you're not the poster child for influencer. You're almost carving the next destination for influencer. So what I'd love to know is, like, what is the one thing that you can't do anymore that you could do when you first started?
Yeah. Oh, you're right, because I think as the market has become more saturated, influencer isn't the new toy, although sometimes it is.
Yeah.
Sometimes it still is. So you can't put together a 10-page deck where it's like, we'll just find you these influencers and it costs this much and yeah, let's go. Like, it's not that anymore. It's got to be backed by strategy, insights, data. The creative wrapper has got to be as good as a creative agency putting a wrapper together. Mm-hmm. The reporting frameworks have got to be brand marketing and performance marketing all at once. There's just so much more rigor in terms of what you put in front of a client. Whereas in the early days, I remember one of the first pitches we went into, it was genuinely 15 slides, and it was a bit just put it out there, see what happens. Oh, this sounds new, let's trial it. Now it's no longer new. Mm. You need to constantly innovate. You need to constantly provide more robust metrics. You need to constantly design a strategy that no one else has thought of. And that just in itself, you think about now our decks for pitches, there are 100 slides, and there's just so much from front to back, just rigor, rigor, rigor.
Yeah. I want to get into this term democratization. I said it then clearly, which is the first for the day.
Yes.
We spoke on the walk here about...
The walk. Do you want to explain why we had to walk here?
We booked a studio that we won't mention, who didn't know we'd booked a studio. And so we're now in a random studio, which no longer will be random to us. This is going to be
really
our...
make me feel special.
Yeah, no, yeah, sorry. Your rider was a cool room and we gave you a brand new one. So yes. I hope you appreciate that. Democratization, I'm saying it just as a word, right? When I hear that, and as a dumb person that isn't in your world as much as you are, when you say there is democratization of creative, essentially, what do you mean?
I think to begin with, it's a democratization of influence. So we've already covered on the kind of TikTok COVID moment. So TikTok creates an algorithm that prioritizes content based around creativity and interest over follower count.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you're sitting there as Ollie with 2,000 followers, you can go viral in the same way as Mr. Beast. In theory, you can do that. Okay. So what does that mean? It means influence used to be this thing where there was a limited supply of influencers and there was a direct correlation with reach. Now all of a sudden the algorithm changes that and you have a limitless supply of influencers almost overnight. And what does that mean?
Anyone
can be an influencer. Anyone can be a creator. So it means that playing field is completely leveled. And that's what we call the democratization of influence.
Can I just break that down
slowly
for my Neanderthal brain?
Yes.
It used to be about having a follower count.
Yes.
And now that is not as relevant.
It's still relevant to an extent, but in a different way. But yeah, it's not. The barrier to entry is far lower now.
In other words, if I have an idea that I want to start my own cooking show and I've got a good hook, whatever, and I go onto my TikTok, I have the same chance to reach wider audiences as Lucy with 100,000 followers would do, because it's based on
creativity.
The creativity of the work that I'm putting out. What does that then lead to?
So then I think the democratization of influence leads to the democratization of creativity. It's like, what does creativity now mean? Is it what Cannes says it is? Is it Michael Cera working with CeraVe? Like, all of those moments are still creative, but I think my issue with creativity is sometimes it feels quite exclusive and almost cult-like, and you walk in a room full of creative directors that are kind of much more traditional and from Adland and look at influencer marketing, like, that's not creative, that's just distribution, that's just easy stuff. When, if brands are living and dying on social, is it not creative to insert influencers into that conversation? And if they're creating media that is dictating the share price of public companies, if it's creating billion-dollar companies, is that not creative?
Yeah.
So then you think about that. Does that then mean they need a seat at the table? So from an agency perspective, does that mean you bring creators in-house into your strategy and creative department? Like, we've done that ourselves. And there's this always like kind of interesting dynamic with clients where you roll out a creator strategist that has 900,000 followers herself, and they're like, oh my God, tell us.
What's the secret?
Yeah. It's like, it's hearing from the source. You're trying before you're buying.
Yeah.
And brands and clients absolutely love that. So is there an argument that even when clients think about their in-house creative teams, do you bring an influencer into the mix? And yes, that's not traditionally creative.
No.
But who's dictating what traditional creativity is? Like, you've got to look at impact as well. And if impact is being driven by creators on social and they're breaking the algorithm with amazing media, then there's an argument to say they have to have a seat at the table. It doesn't mean that we need to completely invert what a creative team is. It means we just need to expand the horizons of it.
Wow. Where does that go? Because when we were speaking, you were saying how, you know, a lot of brands are taking to, you know, their fans essentially to figure out what they want to do next.
Yes.
Like, from a product design perspective, like, this could unlock It's not just communications. It's not just amplification. It could also be
decisions and how they're being made. So if you think about our model, is working with what we call brand fans. This is kind of what we're known for within the space. That's essentially just fans of your product, right? So for our clients, we would work with 10,000 for one client in a year. And that process is very much about discovering who your community is, your true, true community. So at the end of that year, what we tend to do is say, okay, from those 10,000 people, which 100 fans are most loyal to our brand? They're the biggest advocates. And then we move them into a separate community where they're almost like super fans. So you think about the relationship a client can have with those people. It's not just about paying them to post. It's actually, you have the proximity and emotional context around my brand. What does that then mean? It means if I'm releasing a product next, why wouldn't I ask you what you think? Because you think about traditional focus groups, it's Jamie and Ollie sitting in a room as 33-year-old men from London and being asked about something that we have no proximity to.
Yeah.
And then you just give it like a token answer, get your pay at the end of the day and go and spend it down the pub. Like that is focus groups traditionally. But actually, like, invert that idea. If you're asking your community of super fans, they have the emotional proximity to your brand and they can actually steer it into the next direction. Like, they can impact C-suite decision-making, business sort of objectives and outcomes just by having that relationship to your brand.
Wow. Can you give me like, I want to have like a contextual example.
I've got a very good
example. Oh, yes. You've got one with context.
I've got,
because I'm imagining this has got my mind going.
Yeah.
And like, even with Unknown, you know, this is so cheesy, but we wanted, and by the way, you're invited.
Well, I don't know what it is yet, so I'm not saying yes.
We're going to share a bed in a, no.
Okay.
The idea of like classic VVIP or whatever, you know, people that you've worked with that are on the journey that can give you direct feedback to what you're doing.
Yes.
And like, you know, we've been thinking, how do we create our own super fans of...
You tried to get me to be one, right? This is when you said you want to put me in a chair and ask me questions.
That's called the goldfish sessions. That's okay. That is more market research to be like, we plonk you in the middle of our glass office and we're all going to pelt you with questions and be like, you know, how does this work? To be honest, now you've done this podcast, it was probably going to be very similar to this. But like, I'm always thinking, how do you elevate the experience of our super fans or, you know, super users of our business? So it's added value to them and they feel like they're, you know, people want to feel special, right?
Yes.
So tell me, what is your example? I want to hear it.
So we have one client, where they're a makeup brand. They wanted to decide what product to release next. So we basically put a survey out to our community of super fans, but we did it in a way where it wasn't just like a Google type form. It's like, what product should we release next? It wasn't that. We sort of made it very, very visual. So almost like Tinder or Hinge, where we had pictures of potentially new products and the super fans would just go through swipe left, swipe right, swipe left, swipe right, and collected lots and lots of data.
Wow.
And actually what spun out of that, even that in itself, gamifying the experience, making it more social first, we found quite interesting. But the output of that was actually, you're a makeup brand, but we really want you to produce some tanning drops, which they hadn't even thought about. I've used some myself. That's probably why I've got a bit of orange.
So have I.
We've both done it. And they said, okay, let's produce tanning drops. And they were like, okay, we hadn't even previously thought about this. They then went down that rabbit hole. Obviously, they're not just going to blindly listen to their community. No. There's an element of, you know, R&D and just understand all of that. They went down that rabbit hole. And within 24 hours, they sold out completely.
Wow.
So it's their best-selling product in Sephora just from that community super fan based insight. So all of a sudden, you're thinking about the role of influencers in a business. It's no longer we're speaking to a brand manager. We're reaching the CEO now because actually we're impacting what's happening next for the business. And this is when we speak about the democratization of influence and the democratization of creativity. I almost think it's a democratization of decision-making. It almost becomes a democratization of everything. Like, influencers and fans can be used in a much more dynamic way than I think people realize. And that's where I think the industry is headed.
This is kind of breaking my brain because I'm like, I always describe the creative economy quite basically. And you've kind of made me think it's gone full circle, right? So I always say, you've got strategic consultancies at one end, right? Accenture, Deloitte, blending into the brand consultancies. Generally, these people have most of the C's around the table.
Yes.
CEO, CIO, CMO kind of, and that's why Accenture bought Joby 5 and we saw that huge consultancy acquiring Adland because hopefully that will mean that we've got the CMO, right? Then I do this, right? I go, okay, then it goes to sort of, you know, creative agency, you know, they have the CMO, less the CEO, whatever. Then towards the end, you've got like influencer and social and digital. What I'm hearing is like, you know how America and China are the opposite, but actually they're not that far away from each other.
Yes.
It's like it's gone full circle and strategic consultancy is back to back with influencer because you have like coalface.
Influencers can perform that role almost.
Exactly. Yeah. And the interaction between consumer and brand is yes. so iterative, it's so authentic.
Yes.
That the CEOs of those brands give much more of a fuck about what those people are saying.
Well, think about it. Like when you walk into a store, you don't walk into a store and think, I'm Ollie Scott, I'm 33, I'm a white male from London, and I'm going to buy this product. You walk into a store and think, shit, I'm losing my hair, I'm getting some Regain foam. Like it's based, you're not by the way. Maybe I'm going to cry in the back.
Wow, I've heard some horrible things today.
But it always comes from a place of emotion.
Yes.
And you feel something. That's the consumer experience. But in the way we audit the product development process, it takes the emotion out of that. So actually by speaking to your fans, you build the emotion back in. Sorry about the hair.
No, it's all right. I've never been told that.
So yeah, just, you've actually got a very good hairline.
It's what I learned, and now I don't believe that because I am just a human with feelings, okay?
You're going to have to cancel your next podcast.
Yeah.
It's just coming on.
The New York Yankees cat will reappear.
Yeah.
So where does this go for you? Right, so we're at this crazy number. We're going global. I imagine every big holding co has tried to buy you. I imagine private equity is going, hey, do you want to blow this thing up and we'll share the journey?
Yeah.
Where do you see this going? Where do you think, can you play it out?
I think when you become too focused on an exit event, you bend yourself out of shape and you build something for someone else. And I have seen that happen. For us, I just want to build it in the right way. And then I think the opportunities will come. Like I'm not hell-bent on exiting this business to a big network or a big holding company or private equity. I don't really care either way. I just want to build something that has a legacy in the space, that innovates in the space, that understands, okay, influencer is here today, but in 5 years it can be here. Bring AI into that conversation. What role can that play? Mm. I just like the challenge of it all, and I don't really want to be answerable to anyone yet. I feel like we've got a lot more growing to do. But the funny thing is, I think by a lot of time batting away the M&A,
it comes back.
Yeah. Winds them up more.
Yeah.
I think the same motives would say the same. We want to build it for ourselves and what we wanted to create and the people that have joined the business and been on the journey.
Yeah.
And then see where we end up. Like you build it in the right way, the opportunities will come.
I do like, and I mean this, I do get the sense just from getting to know you over the years. I speak to many founders that are like, play by play, they know what they're doing for the, you know, wealth, generational wealth exit they're going to take and da 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 da, right? And I, you know, maybe this might change, but I do genuinely get the feeling when I speak to you that you enjoy the idea of the infinite game.
Yes.
And it is a kind of game, right? Because like you've reached all these different checkpoints. Many would have been happy with expanding to the US and then having, you know, 30 people, whatever. It feels like the size, the numbers aren't really driving you. That's the thing that kind of is a byproduct of what you're doing as a business. What is the thing that makes you go, fuck yeah, okay, that's why we do what we do? Like, is there a moment that happens in your day-to-day life where you go, I love this?
It's from Fridays in the sauna. Always Fridays in the sauna. Like every Friday. What I found, I spoke to you about this on the way in, is it's so hard not to get buried in an operational hole. I think when you're in a fast moving, growing business, and actually the space to just like rock back in your chair and think about stuff without the pressure is super important.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like I don't have enough time for that. But what I enjoy most is the innovative side of it, right? The innovation, the change, the possibility. So on Fridays now, I take time out, I go and sit in the sauna and I just think. And I just think, no, I'm not allowed meetings on Fridays. I don't want to be bothered on Fridays. And there's always a new idea that I end up having. And that's when you say it's not designed in a way where it's year one, we want to do this, year two, we want to do this, year three. There is an element of that, but there's always an element of newness because our space is so fast evolving. If you ask Lucy, who's sitting behind me, every Friday she'll get a barrage of WhatsApps from me that sometimes makes sense. And now we've got this theory where we're trying to say we need to deal in dots. Or no, we need to deal in lines, not dots.
Ooh.
So dots is idea, 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 idea. But now I'm trying to thread them all together. So there is strategic intent, but there's still an element of randomness that you can have and newness that you can have. And yeah, those Fridays, I'm deep down the AI rabbit hole at the moment. Like I'm not an AI fanboy by any means. But I think there's a big opportunity in our space, particularly when you think about influencer. Like our model is based on scale. You're working with lots and lots of influencers. Mm. With that, you have thousands of data points and thousands of pieces of media and content, but clients can't truly understand the value of that because it's just a bit messy in the end. And I think every agency would say the same. That's perfect for AI, right? Because AI is basically data models with an interface on top, essentially. So if you can plug AI into all of those data models that you already have, then the use cases for clients become very, very interesting. They can realize the true value of the work they're doing, as opposed to, can your strategy team build me a deck in 3 weeks and tell me about this one insight? They can get it instantaneously with AI if you build it in the right way, in a very kind of hyper-personalized way. So you think about it, if they could access all of their data, and then you can model other data alongside that, competitor data or industry data, tell me about this product that's performed best in this market in this month and compare that to my competitors in industry benchmarks. All of a sudden, that insight prompt spits out something very hyper-personalized. Okay. For me, that move towards AI, that's when that becomes exciting. It's the use cases that becomes very exciting.
Well, okay, give me an example for like Dior, or maybe if that's one of your clients, then we'll pick the inverse of Dior. Do you work with, you actually work with quite a lot of like the brands in that group?
Yes.
Okay, not Dior.
What do you want?
I want an example of the brand walking through the door and going, right, we want to use this AI tool that you built. Why is that going to make my life as a CMO or whatever my title is easier?
I'll give you a good example with the content side of things. Mm. So when we work with Dior, let's just go back to Dior.
Okay.
No, actually, let's go to another client. Let's go to Armani. Armani is one of our clients. We produce, say, 10,000 pieces of media for them a year from an influencer perspective. Mm. At the moment, or previously in years gone by, that's kind of buried in either the SaaS provider you're using or Google Drive or Dropbox or whatever it is. But all of that content has usage attached to it, which means it has a secondary life or potentially a secondary life on billboards, if you want it to be, digital placements, their own socials, their website, their e-com, whatever it is. But I think at the moment, clients can't navigate how much media they have in a smart and efficient way. Mm. So imagine you're the user and you log on and say, find me a piece of media for this product in this particular moment in these markets with usage for 6 months, and it's right for a banner ad or it's right for a billboard. Then all of a sudden, it can just audit all of those pieces of media and give you something instantaneously. Like, it allows them to use what they already have, but in smarter, strategic ways, as opposed to always having to go bypass the agency and say, I want this, and then the agency has to go and find everything.
Yeah.
And it's super, super messy and convoluted. Actually allows them to just move smarter and faster.
Jesus Christ, I've not thought about that. One thing we've not touched on yet is the question I kind of half asked you before, which is around, if you were to start this, you know, as a 21-year-old kid right now at university, yes. A, would you do this again? And B, how would you approach this world?
Yeah. It's funny, when you first asked that, I think about when we started it and I was just blindly naive to what it would become anyway. So in 8 years, it's going to become this. I always backed us to get it to a certain stage. Yeah. But I never forget a moment, actually. I just have to tell the story very quickly. When Miyamoto's brought in a strategic consultant to sort of audit our business after 3 years, and he looked at us and he's like, you guys have got something. And Miyamoto's looked at each other and we're like, oh, shit, we're going to have to do this now. We're actually going to have to do this now. But if I fast forward to now and I was going to create a business in the creator economy, I wouldn't create an agency. I wouldn't create a talent management company. I think that just ends up being more of the same. Mm. There's enough of that out there. And actually, with the creator economy, when it grows, opportunities grow, but problems grow.
Yeah.
So play in that space, innovate in that space. So for example, we speak about the democratization of everything, right? And that anyone can be an influencer. Let's follow that through. That means being an influencer can be a legitimate professional pathway for many, many people. That opens up a whole world around education, tooling, resourcing. Like, that in itself is a business opportunity. Like, mainstream universities now are offering content creation as part of their sort of program.
Curriculum,
exactly. But actually, if there's an appetite from people that they want to be a creator because the algorithms are telling them that they can be, create a business in that space.
Mm.
Or if you think about the talent side of things, the democratization of everything and anyone can be an influencer, create something for influencers, like tooling for them. Do they understand how to manage their finances in the right kind of way? Do they understand legal frameworks in the right kind of way? Are they going to go to a big legal firm in the city to audit one of their contracts? Probably not. Could AI help with a lot of that? Probably yes. If you think about content itself and sort of AI and content being misappropriated and original assets being turned into something else and they're kind of bending of usage, create something in that space. I mean, we know someone.
Yeah.
In True Rights. Shout out to him.
Shout out to Ben.
Creating something in that space. So it's like, don't just look at the core of what influencer is. Look at everything around the outside and the opportunities and the problems. And then that's where I would build a business. And that's when I think about our business, we're kind of pivoting. We're a service-based business, but we want to move into more of those areas. Like if we work 200,000 influencers per year, that's 200,000 users. That in itself is a Trojan horse to something else, right? Like that could become something else. So there's a lot of opportunities when you look outside the initial kind of parameters of what you're doing.
So if you were, if I went right, 21.
Yes.
Ooh, I just deleted 11 years, 12 years of your life. Give me three parts. What would you do? Bomb, bomb, bomb.
If I was going to create a business now.
Right now, knowing what's happening with AI, knowing where the creator economy has gone.
How much do I want to say? Because a lot of this we want to do anyway. No, actually, because we don't want to do this. I do think there's an opportunity with talent management in the sense that not the traditional model. So if you think about influencers having agents, most people over 50K now will have an agent. Mm-hmm. Typically, they take 20% commission on any deal, right? If you go to any talent agent, my wife is one, so I've asked her this, 90% of her work is logistics. Right. Get to a shoot on time, get a contract signed, approve content, make sure the client gets the metrics, and 10% is revenue generating. Actually, I imagine there's a world where AI can sweep up a lot of that anyway, because logistics and workflows, AI can eat that for breakfast. And then the remaining 10%, which is new business generating, actually, you could just go to an influencer, say, what sectors do you want to work in? You could spit out a gold tier prospect list. You could get all of the contacts. You could automate a lot of outbound. You could build sales collateral, media packs, and they could have that always on outbound new biz generating machine working far more effectively than 10% a talent manager is doing. And the 90% of workflows, you could probably automate a lot of that with AI. Wow. Then all of a sudden you offer that for 15%, 12.5%. Yeah. You completely undercut them. Stuff like that, yeah,
okay,
basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love that. I want to, like, we're being waved, so I want to just get this question in because you had an answer to this earlier when we spoke about it. This is a new segment of the podcast.
Yes.
By the way, you fucking smashed this, man. I've loved this. This has been fun. This is more, is there a human being in the world? This is a, because we're a talent
this is
growth.
Just, it's just such a you question. The front and back of podcast is just so you.
Of course it is. Like, right?
I've gone for your hairline.
Everything. No, I'm not accepting it. Right. Okay. But you have to. We're a talent growth consultancy, yes. Right? We have to shout about humans. It's all about who you don't know, right? Give the people that nobody really knows or recognizes a platform, Jamie Ray.
Yes.
So who is that person to you? Who is the person that you want everyone to know about?
It's funny because when you ask this, my head went to one space immediately. And it might seem like a cop-out answer to people that don't know him, but it is my co-founder, Motez. And you know him and you know why that's a funny answer. I described him earlier as like, he's almost like the Loch Ness monster. He's like, he's a myth that sometimes you feel the energy from, but then he'll disappear. And my analogy with him is always, he's running down the road into the distance, trying to find things, shaking trees, and something will fall out. And I'm behind him just catching like that, basically. But he's the most flamboyant, just immersive personality you will ever come across in your life. He's just ideas,
but no one's seen him.
No, but you very rarely see him. Like sometimes I say in the business, he's like, he's almost a fun uncle that turns up, yeah, and then he disappears and everyone loves him, but then he's back in Saudi or he's back in Mexico, he's back in Brazil. And actually, I think that's why we work so well as a duo is I don't have the headspace to do all of that. Like I'm in it. I'm very in it. And sometimes you want to be on top of it and just not in it. And he is able to do that. But also if you spend time with him, make sure it's at least 2 hours because... Yeah. It's not quick. It's not quick. He can speak.
Yeah, he can.
He can really speak.
Especially in Canada.
And this close to your face.
Yeah. And kind of your ear, he's kind of making love with your ear. Yeah. That's kind of what's going on.
And he's the biggest hype man as well. So if you ever just want to feel good about yourself, give him a ring. And they tell you you're amazing.
We're going to put Motez's number here. Yeah. So if you guys want to get some stuff.
All you single ladies.
Yeah. He's single. So
he's back on the market.
Up. Yeah. Well, look, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
I absolutely love this. Thank you.
No, thank you. All right. I love you.
Wow. Bye.